Hi, everyone. Welcome to This American Quarantine, the show and website to help you survive and thrive while social distancing and sheltering in place. I'm Langdon Basarge. For the last few weeks, we've been discussing the critical and frightening surges in case numbers here in the United States of America. We've brought in experts to help understand why some people deny the science, refuse to wear masks, and information on how and what we can do about it. Today, we bring you a global expert to discuss the desperate need for containing this virus in the United States, but also to help shed some needed light on how science and medicine themselves actually work. We hope that by arming yourself with information and understanding, we can all do a better job of surviving and thriving during coronavirus. I am sincerely proud and honored to introduce you today to Dr. Marcoli Cyril, the Medical Director of Global Development for Amgen, America's top biopharmaceutical company based here in California. They created some of the world's most important medications, including Neupogen and Epogen to treat fatal blood disorders, and a drug you've probably heard of, Enbrel, the very first biologic for autoimmune diseases, such as debilitating arthritis. We recorded this conversation just a few weeks ago when the United States had reached 4 million cases and our death toll had topped 150,000. At the moment I am speaking to you now, in America, we have surged to 5.4 million cases and over 170,000 dead. We need experts now, scientists, doctors, nurses, and we need greater action now more than ever. Here's my unedited conversation with Dr. Cyril. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Marcoli Cyril. It's really good to have you here, sir.
Oh, thank you, and it's my pleasure being here.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how you got to be a physician scientist, because as we were just saying off air, not all scientists obviously are physicians, but certainly not all physicians are scientists. So how was it that what drew you to medicine in general, and then how did you focus in on science and research?
Well, for me, it's kind of like a long, drawn-out journey, so to speak. I was definitely not one of these persons who knew from being a boy that I wanted to be a physician. I was not one of these folks. I would say in my teens, I had a very deep interest in truth in and of itself. And since high school, I always had a deep interest in science, so to speak, because of that. And related to that, also fairly... I would say a pretty serious commitment to philosophy, and I would say more specifically epistemology as far as philosophy is concerned, meaning like how do you know that what you know is indeed truth, so to speak. So there was always that general interest in truth, so to speak. Added to that or wedded to that, I would say that I always had a desire to be kind of like pragmatic. Mm-hmm. And be of service to society. So when I was in college, I had a rough time actually deciding what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. And I finally focused on going into medicine because that made me feel like it would provide me with a venue for being of value to society in a very pragmatic way. So I would say that's what drew me to medicine in and of itself. And wedded to that, like I was saying earlier on, I always had an interest in truth, so to speak. So there's the science part. And as I was training in becoming a physician, and as you know, it's a long process becoming a physician,
And residency is so easy. If the average American citizen knew what you went through in residency to become a physician.
Well, I mean, you know, it's the type of thing that you do once and probably you do not want to repeat because it's so taxing. It's the type of thing that you can only do by being driven by the fire that you may have in the belly, or so to speak. Otherwise, it becomes a burden, and probably it's not something that someone can work through. But it's actually exciting as you're going through the process, because every day is an opportunity to learn, and you're dealing with real life situations. It's not theoretical. It's not didactic, so to speak. So residency and fellowship, all of that time, it's pretty grueling, long process of training, but very rewarding in a lot of ways. So as I was going through residency and fellowship, it sort of became clear to me. I didn't want to simply, once I became a fully credited physician, to simply, somewhat in a passive way, just see patients and take care of patients. I felt like I needed something a little bit more dynamic, and my curiosity in science didn't stop there. So I thought that I would look into possibilities in being in academic medicine, so to speak. And so
by academic, do you mean teaching or research or both?
Or right neither. Now, I think right now, because of how the environment is into taking care of people, it's extremely difficult to do all of that. But if you're thinking of the 19th century, and if you're thinking of like the fathers of medicine, so to speak, or the fathers of modern medicine, like Osler, so to speak, and the type of thing, they really did a combination of all this. Like, they were taking care of people, they were teaching, and they were at the same time doing research. But as things have evolved, it has become extremely challenging to do all of that. So you sort of have to pick and choose what you want to do. It was not entirely clear to me what I would do. I for my training, I went to highly research-oriented places, and for a long time I thought that maybe I would be the type of scientist that would spend quite a bit of my time in the lab, and maybe spending a little bit of time taking care of patients. But that evolved, and there's something in medicine called translational science, and translational science means that you try to bring what you're doing to the lab to the bedside as much as possible.
Moving it from theory to application.
Exactly. Because you can be in the lab and you can be working on a protein for 30, 40 years. And it may be an interesting research question that you're pursuing. And there's value in that. But it may be far from finding a place in a practical medicine or application in medicine, so to speak. So while I was trained, while I was being trained, I sort of conveyed that to my preceptors, and they sort of encouraged me. And they said, "Oh, well, maybe you should look into the pharmaceutical and biotechnology area, because they are as close to having something close to the bedside as you can get into medicine." So eventually, I made the transition from being in academia, so to speak, to quote unquote what we call the industry. So I made the transition from being in academia to becoming a scientist in the biotechnology, so to speak. And that's where it evolved. So I had to sacrifice in doing this, because like I was saying earlier on, you cannot do everything nowadays. Mm-hmm. You sort of have to pick and choose. Either you are taking care of patients, or you are teaching, or maybe you're doing a combo of teaching and taking your vision at the same time, or you're spending most of your time in the lab. So now I work at Amgen, which is a biotechnology company, and I'm a clinical research medical director at Amgen. Essentially what we do in terms of folks who are in my role is trying to bring something that was discovered to patient care. So we quote unquote develop medicine, we develop new therapies, new therapeutics, so to speak. So that's what I do at Amgen. Talk to the scientists, work with the scientists, try and use what they have produced, develop it to something that can benefit the people's lives, so to speak, and do everything that's related to the requirements of bringing something to patient care, so to speak, and the how would I say, the dream of people who are doing what I do is getting an approval from various regulatory agencies and say, okay, your drug has been approved for X, Y, or Z. That's what I do.
It's so fascinating to me on a few levels. I want to pick up on a few things that you said in a moment, but in listening to you just now, Dr. Cyril, as a nurse, sometimes one of my main roles is to encourage people to take their medicine. And in various communities, I hear over and over again, the pharmaceutical agencies, companies.
I'm sorry, let me stop you. Let me stop you there because you froze at the moment. So I didn't hear what you said. Last thing that I heard was as a nurse.
Oh, got
then,
it.
And then you froze. Okay, sorry.
God bless the internet. Right?
Yes.
As a nurse, I one of my main jobs has always been to, you know, administer medication and assist people with their medications. And throughout the years, there's always an underlying recurrent theme surrounding maybe reluctance to take medication or even reluctance to believe in the science of why a medication works or why this patient needs the medication. And we hear how, well, the pharmaceutical companies just want to make money. So as you were talking, obviously the company needs to make money. It has to pay its employees. It has to pay its shareholders if it's, you know, a publicly optioned company. But the tremendous amount of dedication, what you were talking about in wanting to develop these new therapeutics. And so kind of focusing in on that word therapy, therapeutic, obviously the desire to help via this one aspect of medicine, you know, which is biochemical, to help a disease process or to help a symptom. And in listening to you talk about your journey, it just really hit home for me what is in the hearts and minds of the scientists that are doing this. And with your continual kind of dual focus of wanting to be with the patients and be at the bedside and help them and be able to deliver something that will help, just really struck me kind of deeply as I was hearing you, because I could hear your passion.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm glad that some of this is resonating with you. I have to say that I think that there's quite a bit of misunderstanding of what it takes to bring to a patient what has been discovered and the process and what it requires to meet various standards that have been put in place. I mean, obviously, there's a long history. There's like more than 100 years history in terms of developing the agencies that regulate drug approval. And also, I think there's also confusion as to what's available to consumers from, let's say, whatever it is that they can go into a grocery store or whatever place, wherever they can go, and whatever people might claim, versus a drug that has been approved either by the European agency or by the FDA or various kinds of governmental authorities in various places in the world. And also, I think there's confusion as to, and I don't know if we want to get into this right now, but as to how drug prices established, et cetera. But I can tell you, in working with my colleagues and looking at their commitments and their dream and their vision, the desire is really to be of service. As you said, we still have to pay rent. We still have to have a roof over our heads. Yes, what we do, there's a profit component to that. I think the general perception is somewhat skewed, I believe, against pharmaceutical industry because of various propagandas, etc.
Yeah. Let me just ask you kind of hypothetically, let's take Enbrel, which was the first biologic, and Amgen developed it. So, which is amazing. It opened up an entire new field of therapeutics for people with various inflammatory diseases and lots of broad cross application with a medication like that and with the biologics. So just kind of, and I know you don't have a spreadsheet or anything like that in front of you, but just for helping us understand about how many scientists were involved in investigating that one drug. And then I know that it wasn't just one study, right? So we had to look at what the biologic is, how does it work in the body, how does it affect the various systems. So there's multiple studies. So just ballpark, how many studies do you think it took on that chemical compound? How many scientists do you think were involved? And then just tell me how many, because I know it's years. How many years?
Yeah. Well. Okay. It takes quite a bit, quite a long time in terms of having a candidate drug that's been identified in the lab to actually bring it to market. The average. This is just the average. The average is about. It takes 12 to 13 years.
Wow.
Right? 12 to 15 years, and that's just on average. And the attrition rate also is pretty high. And what I'm meaning by attrition rate is that, I mean, various companies have various levels of what you would call success. But out of 10 candidates that you may have that you've begun with in terms of like things that have the potential to become of use in patient care, out of 10 candidates, maybe two or three of them are actually going to make it, meaning like going through the process. So various companies are getting better, mm-hmm. And also not only in terms of having a higher success rate, but also in terms of shortening the length of time it takes from drug discovery, meaning having a drug candidate to actually bringing it to market. So your original question was how many scientists? Oh my God. I'm going to try and give you some insight, but I would say probably in the hundreds. Wow. But I think I need to sort of spell out some details so that it sort of makes sense. First, there are the scientists involved in the drug discovery itself in the lab, right? And here it's probably a team working on something. And a team working on something in the lab, probably it's about roughly, let's say, 20 people, right? Once a candidate has been identified in the lab, then you have to take it to through development. And development takes various phases. Typically, the classical timeline is three phases, meaning there's a phase one, there's a phase two, and there's a phase three. Phase one, it's when you take whatever you had in the lab, when you have shown in the lab that it's safe with animals, and you've done various things looking at what kind of possible toxicities that you might predict, etc., in various ways. Some of that you do it in petri dishes, some of that you have to do it with animals, because Although that's not perfect, but that's the best predictive models that we have. Once we have that, then we do the phase one trials where we only have very, very few volunteers. Usually it's healthy volunteers.
And just to clarify, sorry to interrupt you, all of these studies are done before phase one. So phase one is what we describe when it's a study involving a human. This is the first set of studies in vivo with a human. So
exactly. So the phase one are first in human studies. And for these studies, you really have very, very few volunteers. And you start at very, very small doses of the drug. And then you go at higher and higher. At first, you give only one dose, and then you give two doses, and then you give three doses. And you essentially are on high alert and you're hypervigilant because you're looking for possible unknown toxicities, like toxicities that you didn't anticipate. So that's the first phase. At that time, you're not trying to find out whether your drug is doing and what you think it should be doing in terms of helping people. Once you're satisfied that your drug is safe, then you take it to phase two. So in phase two, what you try and find out there is actually having a hint, having somewhat a proof that your drug is doing what you think it should be doing. So that's what we call the proof of concept step. So that's phase two. These studies are larger than in phase one, but they are still in somewhat a restricted number of people. And you're still monitoring for possible toxicities that you might not have anticipated. And in trying to tie that in also to the earlier question that you asked me, so in addition to the scientists that you had in the lab, you have other types of scientists that specifically are trained in drug toxicity in phase one who are looking at this part. And at the same time, they're learning what the drug does to the body in terms of how it's absorbed in the body, how it's distributed in the body, how it's excreted, how the body gets rid of it. Also trying to get a sense of how much of the drug you need for the drug to do what you think it should be doing. You continue doing that, and in phase two, you get your proof of concept. A lot of drugs get quote-unquote killed, I would say, or eliminated at that phase, because a lot of time, whatever you identify as a candidate drug in your lab, either in phase one or in phase two, they show that humans are not going to be able to tolerate it. It may be a tolerability issue, or it may be a toxicity issue. Mm-hmm. And the difference, what I mean by that, I mean, let's say, for example, a drug make you really nauseated. You know, that's not necessarily toxic, but you may not be able to tolerate the drug because it makes you so nauseated that it loses its value. It becomes intolerable, right? So there's that. And then in phase two, when you try and do your proof of concept, you may find out, well, your drug is not effective. Exactly. So even though you had all kinds of models, animal models that told you it should be doing X, Y, and Z, you're not seeing that. Or it could be doing this, but the doses that would be required for it to do it would be so high that it's just not safe to do that. So a lot of drugs get eliminated at that phase. Once you're satisfied in phase three, which are still somewhat small, then you're going to a larger trial in phase three, and usually these studies are called confirmatory trials because you're trying to confirm the proof of concept that you saw in phase two. And these studies are large for a number of reasons, because first you want to truly confirm that what you think you saw in phase two is real, but in addition you want to be able to pick up possible toxicities that you didn't see in your earlier studies. Because as we know, as human beings, we're not all alike. There are differences amongst us. And Some people have particular reactions for whatever reason, maybe because of their genetic makeup, their genetic background. So then you have to identify whether there are issues that are manageable versus issues that are not manageable in these large trials.
I think that's an important point too, Dr. Cyril, for consumers to understand. When we're doing these smaller studies, there may only be a couple hundred, and then in a phase two, a couple of thousand, or maybe then as we move to phase three, we're looking at usually, hopefully, 10,000, right? Like a large N, so we can make broad generalizations to the public at large. So there may be some subgroup that have a particular sensitivity, but if there were no members of that subgroup in phase one or phase two, we're not going to see it. So we won't know, because people, I'll get that from patients a lot, or even friends in my life will say, well, why didn't we know that? You know, or a drug will come to market actually, and then 5 years later, we learn it could do X, Y, and Z for a very small amount of people. And they say, well, why didn't we know that? Because until we went from a couple thousand people taking it to now a couple million over time. And so now we learn. And what I usually try to tell them is, number one, you know, we're always learning. But I always tell them, too, science is self-correcting. So, you know, when people hear, my dad used to say, my Southern Alabama-born father, who was a professor, would say, oh, you know, one day hot dogs are going to kill you. One day hot dogs are good for you. One day eggs. And I would hear that from patients, too. You know, why won't the damn scientists and doctors make up their minds? You know, and that's one of the, especially as an educator myself, one of the challenges to try to convey to patients, clients, the public, that science is always self-correcting. And even then, like if we take eggs, for example, what aspect are we looking at? And the difference between us as scientists and educators looking at things, analyzing them, and making recommendations, the modern press will jump on a very tiny study. And as you know, we do not do any medical recommendations based on one study, right? We need to see replication studies. We need to analyze the study. Was it well done? Was it peer reviewed? Was it well controlled? But the press will jump on it and then have these, you know, crazy headlines that then gets people all crazy. And then the interesting thing is the general public does not get frustrated with the press. They get frustrated with the doctors, the nurses, and the scientists.
Exactly. You made a lot of very, very, very important comments and important points. And actually, it would take quite a while to unpack some of what you said, because it's so layered and there are so many important points that you made. There are a number of things that are important to understand. When we do our proof of concept studies, a lot of that is determined by what our statisticians call the power of the study. So the size of the study in a proof of concept study is going to be determined on what you anticipate, quote unquote, what we call, and I don't want to get too technical, but I'm going to be a little bit technical here, what we call the treatment effect size. The treatment effect size versus what you think the placebo response may be, and that will determine the size of the proof of concept studies. When you go into the confirmatory studies, which are larger studies, we don't take just into account the statistical power in terms of trying to understand whether the drug is effective or not. We try to have enough people of various background exposed to the drug so that you have a fairly good sense of what the safety profile of the drug is going to be, depending on what indication you're going for. And what I mean by that is what kind of disease, whether you're going for heart disease or diabetes or rheumatoid arthritis or inflammatory bowel disease, actually these may determine the size of your study. Because regulators, and by regulators I mean the FDA, the European agency, the PMDA, which is the Japanese equivalent of the FDA, etc., A lot of time they do have pre-specified size of the study that you need to have for them to be satisfied with the exposure level that you have had for your drug. And to go back to something you said earlier on, usually proof of concept studies, which are safety, which are phase two studies, they can be a few hundred people. Confirmatory trials are a few thousands, but there are a lot of different kinds of confirmatory trials. The largest kinds of confirmatory trials that we have are what we call outcome studies. And for outcome studies, we're looking at mortality or very significant benefits, that meaning like cardiovascular benefits, et cetera, that type of thing. And for these studies, you need really large numbers, sometimes even close to 30,000 subjects. But as you said earlier, once you get authorization to have the market, the drug in the market, so to speak, now you're going to get millions of people exposed to what you've done. And getting that level of exposure is just not doable in terms of having a clinical trial. And the clinical trial, although we try to mimic, quote unquote, the real world, the clinical trial is still not the real world. I mean, you have fairly specific framework around which you're studying your drug. And just in terms of feasibility and practicality, you sort of have to have these elements in place so that you can conduct the trial. But once your drug gets authorization, now the drug is in the real world. And the real world is different than whatever you had in the clinical trials. Also, you try to mimic it as much as you can. And sometimes unforeseen events and things happen in the real world that you did not anticipate. And as you said earlier on, science is very is self-correcting. So as time goes by, we learn, we correct, and we address. And this is why also at times there are certain drugs that have been approved and then they get pulled out. That's very unfortunate, but it happens. And I guess people also consumers should realize that even after you get a drug approved, you do have certain commitments from there are things that we still have to do. In other words, once we get the drug approved, it doesn't mean that we're all done and it's over and that we pull back. No, we still continue doing other studies to confirm that the drug is safe, etc. And if need be, then we have to revise the label of the drug depending on the new findings, etc. As I said earlier on, I think I probably told you that off air. I can talk quite a bit. So it's a very fascinating process, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about this because I think that probably the general public is not aware of how it happens and the rationale also behind what we do, why, you know, et cetera. So I'm glad to have the opportunity.
I went to who I think would be best to help us have this conversation. And you know that I chose you specifically. I wanted you to be having this conversation with our listeners.
Thank you.
So with the idea of misunderstandings, let's talk about real quickly this same process that you've described for drug development. When we're thinking now of COVID-19 specifically, this would be the same process that scientists are going through with consideration of the development of a vaccine, correct?
Yes. It's modified in the sense that a vaccine is not a drug, but it's an intervention. So the process that I describe is similar to any kind of intervention that you would do. So when you do an intervention, you're comparing groups. You're comparing the groups in which you intervene versus the group in which you did not have an intervention. So the drug is different than the vaccine development because for a drug, it's we're administering a product, and depending on what kind of disease that we're treating, it may be something that we're giving continuously over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Whereas for a vaccine, you intervene at a certain point in time, and you may boost your intervention, but essentially it's kind of like you do the intervention at this point in time, but you're not chronically, you're not continuously intervening. So there's that difference. But yes, you're correct. There's the same process. In other words, the first step is you're trying a small number of people and try to get a sense that what you're doing is safe. Once you have that sense, then you go into a larger pool of people and trying to get a sense of your intervention is doing what you think it should be doing. And then you finally, before you get approval, you're doing a larger phase. So what's happening with the vaccine for COVID-19, it's a little bit different because the process that I described to you is the classic way of doing things. But there are innovative and ways that we can do things in trying to accelerate. And as we say, having needs is the mother of invention, so to speak. We're in a situation where urgency is of essence.
Yes.
So there's something that's called adaptive drug development design, where you try to combine some of the phases. You can combine the phase two or phase three, or you can combine phase one and phase two. So one of you can hear that a lot of scientists are saying that it usually takes years and years to develop this, and we think we're going to be developing this very quickly. What's being done is that people are contracting the timeline. They are trying to combine. So obviously there are risks in doing this, but at the same time, given the urgency, I guess there is a sense of we cannot afford to how would I say, like, let's not make perfect the enemy of good type
of
thing.
Yes, because the normal process would take possibly years to develop a vaccine. And by accelerating it and contracting some of these phases and combining them, we're hopefully accelerating the timeline. So hopefully we can have a vaccine much sooner than we normally would have. And I would add to that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Cyril, obviously we'll correct anything as we go along. Science is self-correcting. So if we realize, oops, this vaccine combination is not quite as effective as this, so we're going to tweak them to go this way. Or, oops, it turns out we do need a booster. So once every 3 years, 5 years, whatever, just like we did with the measles, mumps, rubella, MMR, we know you may need a booster. So we'll figure that out as we go, but we're not going to delay, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we should underline that even though this is going to an accelerated process, it's being done with a lot of scrutiny, and it's being done as safe as we know that we can do things safely, so to speak. In other words, we're not, as a community, the scientific community is not throwing away our vigilance or our precautionary methods, so to speak. But at the same time, this is a situation where a lot more resources are put into that situation than you typically have. Not only in terms of, the scientific community trying to produce this, but also in terms of government assistance and resources that are being put to facilitate this. As you know, I think there are some sponsors who have reached phase three for their vaccine trials already, which is really kind of like record-breaking in a matter in less than a year.
It's astounding.
Yes.
There's three or four candidates, correct, that are moving into phase three?
I believe so. But what I wanted to highlight is that for these large studies, we're talking 30,000 subjects. I mean, and I prefer to say patients, also subjects, is a technical term.
A little more personal.
Yes, but I'm trying to point out that I think that probably one of the intent here is trying to get as broad of an exposure as possible, because this is these candidate vaccine are slated to come to us as quickly as possible.
With that process, and in my mind, based on the studies that I had seen and what I knew just from being a nurse, I've been encouraging people and telling people part of why we have to be so vigilant and remain so vigilant with our precautions for COVID-19 is because of how long a traditional vaccine would take, but that even with the amazing push from scientists and from companies and from governments, that probably the earliest we can expect a vaccine to be demonstrated effective and safe and then brought to the production side of the market would be December/January of 2021. And then we won't really see a full result maybe for 6 months to a year after because of the production demands and then distribution. So distribution of this vaccine worldwide and then each country's own distribution and administration protocols, etc. So this is going to take time. It's not that the vaccine will come out and then boom, we're all magically immune. Am I wrong in that timeline as far as how we need to prepare Americans and really all global citizens to be patient and to remain vigilant, that we won't really... I think what most people want to know, and I'm sorry, I'm not being very articulate, okay, Dr. Cyril. Most Americans want to know, when can I go back to normal, right? When can I just relax? And I always say, relax now. Don't be paranoid, but you have to be vigilant, right? We're going to probably have to remain in some form of social distancing protocol, not necessarily quarantining, but sheltering, meaning staying home as much as possible, minimizing, right? And definitely wearing masks for at least, in my mind, what I've been telling people is at least through, I would say, next summer, maybe even into next fall, winter.
Yes. I think that's the billion-dollar question, right? We all want to know when are things going to, quote-unquote, get back to normal. I think probably it's worth maybe quoting Dr. Fauci mm-hmm. a little bit, like, because probably he has one of the best informed insight as to what we can anticipate in terms of where things are as far as for the foreseeable future. And I believe that as late as yesterday that he was stating that probably we may have a vaccine by late fall. I mean, I think that's optimistic, but I think that's probably one of the better informed insight as to when we may have a vaccine available. And to your point, having something approved doesn't necessarily mean it's available the next day. What I do know is that some sponsors of these vaccines, even before getting approval from various regulators, they already started mass production to try to address exactly what you just underlined, meaning that once it's approved doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be accessible and available for everyone. But I guess that... time is of the essence, and expediency is important in terms of availability of these vital vaccines. So from what I'm reading, it seems that some sponsors have already committed to mass production early. So hopefully it's not going to be too long after a vaccine is approved for it to become available. Now, how does that translate into quote unquote herd immunity? I feel like I can't speculate on that. That's a big question. That's an important question. And I think that we're going to learn as we go. But I think this is very optimistic. Just for the sake of balance, I will also provide the picture of the most pessimistic view. The most pessimistic view would be us going through something similar to what happened with the Spanish flu in 1918. And people should know, and I think it's important to be informed about it, simply to set realistic expectations, so to speak, that it took about 2 to 3 years for the Spanish flu of 1918 to have a complete public resolution, so to speak. So that's the worst scenario. So that's the most pessimistic. But I think the optimistic view is that it seems like we have reasons to believe that a viable vaccine may be available late fall this year. And here again, I'm just deferring to Dr. Fauci, and how that translates in terms of availability to the public. That's the next step. But that's a very crucial and important step, though, to get something approved. Because I think that probably that's going to be our ticket to quote unquote return to normalcy.
I think so too. Yeah. And even then, I think, like in my mind, and I know off air you and I talked about this, I really want to go to Paris. I need a vacation. Right? Excuse me, my allergies.
It's okay.
I'm not going to go have a vaccine and then hop on a plane to Paris. I'm just not. I'm going to, you know, remain careful and cautious, and I'm going to follow the news, you know. We froze. I think it's your internet.
Okay, I was going to say yes, you froze again. I'm sorry, but
totally okay.
What I heard is that you want to go to Paris, but you want to be careful about it. You're not just going to nonchalantly hop on the plane. And, you're going to be vigilant, but you want a vaccine so that you can go to Paris.
Exactly. So this has been wonderful. You've helped me clarify some misunderstandings. I just want to hone in on that idea of misunderstandings for a minute. Is there anything else, Dr. Cyril, that you see in the general public or even with your patients, any misunderstandings we need to kind of help clear up, even just in this conversation with our listeners at This American Quarantine? Specific to say COVID and what's going on right now, whether with masks or with hydroxychloroquine or the need for social distancing, any other misunderstandings that you're seeing that are still kind of prevalent?
Perhaps I'm not going to make a declarative statement, but what I would say is that when people are getting their information and making decisions based on what they are hearing, they really need to take ownership as to being responsible as to who they pay attention to and why are they paying attention to that particular individual. If you see something on Twitter or if you see something on Facebook and you don't know the source and people are making statements, you should be responsible if you're going to take that information and then let that information inform your behavior. And not only that, but in terms of what you tell other people to do. Oh, I heard, or oh, I read, or like I think it's extremely important to make sure that people look at a lot of different kind of sources. Mm-hmm. and know what is the accreditation of your source. Who is saying it? Why are they saying it? And are they motivated by what is their motivation for them saying what they are saying? I think it's extremely important. And I think also that people should try and differentiate information that's coming from the scientific community versus information that's coming from the pseudo-scientific community. that may be a bit hard for people to sort of clear out. But I would say try to err on the side of being highly skeptical. About your source.
Who are your favorite sources for, not just you as a scientist, because I know, you know, I do read JAMA and a few other journals still, but the average person is not. So what sources would you recommend that citizens can go to maybe fact check health and wellness science type? I usually send people primarily if it's health. My favorite, because it's very clean, they're not beholden to any pharmaceutical companies, and they don't advertise on their website. I usually send people to mayoclinic.org. It's the simplest. They actually show their citations. If you want to learn more about the science, you can. That's usually my first go-to for patients in general. Specifically right now, like at This American Quarantine, we've just partnered with Johns Hopkins. So now all of our data is updated right from the homepage in real time. So people can see the numbers, can see the map, can go to those resources linked with Johns Hopkins, plus the other, you know, and for us, we always tell people that it should be evidence-based. And we have given a very small number, actually. There's probably only four or five on the website where we're encouraging people to go to get their information to help kind of make sure that it's accurate and that we're not spreading misinformation.
Yeah. I mean, I would say in general, so just as a general sense check, if you go to the website of any website that's kind of like affiliated to a recognized university or healthcare provider, whether it's the Mayo Clinic or Johns Hopkins or University of California, San Francisco, Mass General Hospital, et cetera, et cetera. My point being, if it's affiliated to a healthcare provider that's recognized, and maybe a quick cheat sheet is that maybe go to U.S. News and looking at the ranking of the hospital, et cetera, and try and see, you know, like these are recognized, accredited health organizations, all the information that they have there. I think as a general rule, you can assume that that information is credible. In addition to everything that you said, I guess in general, I would be going to the CDC site and the World Health Organization site. I know that there have been some political comments related to this, but since you were asking me, what do I go to? I definitely consult the CDC and I definitely consult the World Health Organization, and their information is credible. Obviously, I'm skewed. I'm a scientist myself, so I have ways of, vetting or scrutinizing what I read that probably wouldn't be available to the average consumer. But I endorse everything that you said, and I definitely think, as a general rule, if someone goes to a site associated to a well-recognized academic center, that is safe to assume that the information there is credible. It's usually peer-reviewed and rigorously looked at, probably discussed among colleagues. and to what you said, like I said earlier on, I would just add the CDC and the World Health Organization.
Wonderful. We have linked to them, and the CDC still is. I personally, and I'll share it with listeners, because one of my concerns is about what's happening over the last, say, 3 to 6 years with a general distrust of government and a distrust of science happening. And so I would never want to disparage, say, for example, the CDC. Always, this organization has been evidence-based, based on the best science, the best that doctors and scientists have to offer. What's happened recently with the current administration and the U.S. federal government is that the organizational, not necessarily the work that's on the ground, but the releases that are coming out are political. And so I am a little concerned there. We still link to them. And I'm doubly concerned because I don't like that I myself am seeing that. And I don't want, as this country moves forward, hopefully for decades, centuries, I don't want the average citizen to doubt what comes out from the CDC, for example. But what has occurred in the coronavirus response was alarming to me as a medical professional, both in the incorrect test kits that were sent out at the beginning, and the poor communication and the poor coordination between public health departments from state to state. And then as we've come forward, their reluctance to kind of push back and do what all doctors and nurses take oaths to do, because of the political environment. And then in the third scenario with the school reopening and the CDC, they issued great guidelines, but now the administration has basically ignored those guidelines. And now they've essentially released guidelines under the guise of the CDC, but they were written by White House staff. And it has the CDC label on it. And that, as far as I know, that has never happened in the history of that organization, of the CDC. So I have double concerns there, because I'm always telling Americans, I'm always telling listeners, trust, you know, if it has a .gov website, you know, like usually when I'm doing health education and people ask me, where do I go? Similar to your answer, I would say, look for, if it says .com, question it. Click about, who are they? If you can see their board of directors, if you see nurses, doctors, scientists, dietitians, okay. If you see Nestle, McDonald's, you know, that's maybe not where you want to go. So .edu, .org in general, right? I just personally, professionally, especially because there's a plethora of other wonderful sources, I personally am not sending anyone to the CDC right now, because you can find out how to wash your hands anywhere. You can find out how to put a mask on anywhere. And there's certainly enough scientists, physicians that are on record for saying that a lot of what has happened with the CDC since February is questionable medically and ethically. That's just me personally. And I don't even know if my producers will allow me to air this part of the conversation. But for the record, I just felt like I had to at least share it with you, Dr. Sorrell.
Understood. And I have to say, it's unfortunate that the current climate creates that type of caution. And I have to say that I understand you. Myself being a scientist, I think that I'm fortunate that I can filter out for myself what is evidence-based versus what is not, what may have a different kind of motive behind it. And I think, unfortunately, the general consumer is just not equipped to make that differentiation. I think, in general, like we were saying earlier on, if we look at what you're calling .edus, meaning by that academic centers, we can fairly assume that they're independent, and there's not a political motive behind statements that they make. What I would say is for people to try and be balanced. But again, I would return to taking responsibility as to your choices of sources. Because at least people will know whether they're being honest with themselves or not in terms of the choice they make for which kind of source that they look at. Because if one chooses to go to a particular source and they know that that particular source has some political leanings, you are willfully going to that source. So if you're looking at yourself in the mirror, you knew that you went to that choice for whatever reason. But for someone who is interested in looking at truth, independent of political motives, et cetera, or leanings, take the responsibility as to what kind of choice you're making, as to which source you're looking at.
This brings us full circle, really, which is wonderful for the conclusion to our conversation, Dr. Cyril, because you mentioned earlier an opportunity to learn when you were talking about your journey into medicine and science, but then also as we started talking about sourcing for information. And so this is an opportunity for us to learn. Just in my head, I was thinking of my own family. My brother, who's an avid fisherman, will study everything about this rod and this reel and the water conditions and this because he's passionate about it. You know, others, they'll study and go to the experts on this new stereo or this new car or this new blender. So I'm going to encourage our listeners to use a little bit of that same passion and discernment when you're looking for your news, your information, and certainly your health information. Don't look at it as a burden or a chore. Look at it as that opportunity to learn and just kind of dig in a little, you know?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, health should be high on the list of priorities. And if you're serious about your health, well, you better be discriminatory as to where you get your information for your health.
That's the only place that I personally would recommend discrimination, right? Not based on religion, weight, color, but certainly discriminate in your acquisition of health information.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a responsibility. I mean, doing otherwise, it's absolutely, utterly irresponsible.
I agree with you so much. And I thank you so much for your time, Dr. Cyril.
You're very welcome. And it's been really my pleasure. And like I said, probably folks like me do not have a lot of opportunity to be a voice directly to consumers. And if that's bringing insight to some people, well, then I'm happy.
I would love it if you came back, because I would love to discuss more with you some of the other words at the beginning of your conversation that I find very inspiring. You mentioned truth over and over, and you mentioned service over and over. And then there was that opportunity to learn. And then for me, what is a magic word? Curiosity. And I think those are powerful, and I would love it if you'd come back in the future and talk with us about those.
Okay, well, if you send me an invitation, there you have it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Okay. And thank you for everything that you are doing. I know that you are actually the global response leader for your company, and you're doing a lot of work.
Oh, let me edit that a little bit. So we have various things that we're doing. I'm a clinical research medical director in the cardiometabolic therapeutic area. We have a portfolio that's emerging for obesity, and I'm the global development leader for that portfolio. So
for what portfolio?
Obesity.
For obesity?
Yes.
Got it. Global development lead. Okay.
So I have a little bit of an accent, so sometimes.
A little. Well, okay. My friend, I think we're done.
Okay.
Yeah, I think what I'll do is tape. I'm still recording. So of course the poor editor has to cut all this out. I think I'll just I'll just say goodbye one more time for the record. Although all this will probably be cut.
No problem. Okay.
So again, thank you so much, Dr. Storrell. So again, thank you so much, Dr. Cyril. Stay well and stay safe in that laboratory.
Well, thank you so much, and I wish you the same.
That was Yale graduate Dr. Marcoli Cyril, Medical Director, Global Development for Amgen. My sincere thanks to Dr. Cyril and to Amgen for their participation today and their work for all of us tomorrow. That's our show. As always, thanks so much for listening. I hope this conversation today and on our many other episodes have helped raise your awareness and your spirits. If you'd like to respond to the show or share your experiences, reflections, email us at info@thisamquarantine.org or call us and leave us a voicemail, 562-674-0775. We'd love to hear from you, and we might just play your message on the air. Remember, we're also in the middle of our media campaign to help the hashtag Wear a Mask and the hashtag and organization Mask Up. Hopefully, through positive messaging, people will get the message and start to wear masks. So send us a selfie or a video, 15 seconds or about a minute and a half. Longer ones will go on Instagram, possibly YouTube. Shorter ones will be on Twitter and TikTok. You can follow us on TikTok and Instagram. The handles are 411 versus 911. And of course, follow us on Twitter at @AMQuarantine. And remember, at the website, the expansive resource directory with the latest in health and safety information, thanks to our collaboration with Johns Hopkins University. And of course, expert help on how to stay safe and how to cope during this ongoing challenge that we're still all facing. Please remember to subscribe if you haven't already and share with all the members of your quarantine. We appreciate you listening, and we've seen the growth. With your help, we can help more people, and together, we'll get through this. So stay safe, stay well, and as always, stay in touch.